Computer, initialize holosuite.
Good evening and welcome to another episode of The Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Perry, joined with my other co-host here, David. David, say hi.
Hey, Perry. Hey, guys. Tonight we're talking about Season 1, Episode 8, The Passenger. Before we continue, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts as The Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast.
Absolutely, and please do find us and follow us and send us questions and comments, and I promise that we will answer only the ones that we like. So yes, tonight we are talking about The Passenger, but before we get into that episode, I want to stop and take a moment and ask David a couple of quick questions. First and foremost, how are you liking watching Deep Space Nine so far?
Yeah, so there's a difference between watching The Next Generation for me and Deep Space Nine right now, because I am in the middle of Season 7 of The Next Generation, and I'm watching those episodes back-to-back, each night watching an episode, and so right now I definitely feel more invested in the cast of The Next Generation, knowing their story, because I've been watching them over the last 2 months very close to back-to-back. And then watching Deep Space Nine once a week in order to prepare for the show we're doing together is definitely interesting, because I'm very invested in the Next Generation cast and those storylines. It's easier to kind of just go from episode to episode to episode. So I'm enjoying Deep Space Nine, but for the moment, and I think you'll agree with this statement, the Next Generation, being in Season 7, has found its stride, knows what it is, knows what it has to do to make an interesting story. While Deep Space Nine, like the first season of The Next Generation, is having to work through that same process. And so right now, I enjoy the Deep Space Nine episodes fine, but I really do look forward to some really... like this episode, The Passenger, was an interesting episode. Don't have any real big complaints about it, but I'm still waiting for the real cohesion of the characters to really find their groove amongst each other, really waiting for a moment where like they're all together as a team having to figure out something, as opposed to one person like Dr. Bashir in this episode is figuring out the medical side, and then we have them, some of them up on the command center area, and they're having to figure a couple things out. So far, I haven't felt like we have a real cohesive group yet. There's no let's go up to the conference room or the ready room on the Enterprise and let's talk about our problem and figure it out as a group. There's no situation like that yet. So I'm really kind of waiting for that moment where I feel like we've really got a team. At this point, it feels like people could drop from the cast and other people could join the cast, and we haven't yet lost or gained anything by if that were to happen. But on the whole, everything's been fine so far. A couple episodes back, I think you got you and our other guest, whose name Jordan. I can't remember right now. Remind me before Jordan. When Jordan joined us, he suggested that Deep Space Nine gets much better once he gets on to Season 2. And I feel, again, like The Next Generation was similar. So knowing that he felt that way and that you seem to agree, right now I'm happy to go along for the ride and look forward to those episodes that you seem to really be looking forward to. So yeah, it's been fun, but again, right now I am much more invested right now in my Next Generation watch than I am right now in my Deep Space Nine watch. But I look forward to getting to know the cast really well and joining my interest of the two shows into a more equal enjoyment of both.
Okay. So yeah, I would say that you're definitely, seeing the potential. Like, I think, just like Next Generation, Deep Space Nine uses the first season to really help you establish character traits. So, right. Yes, we have a lot of one-off episodes, like this episode's about Dax, this one's about Bashir, this one's about Sisko, you know, like things like that, because it's necessary for you to understand each character's perspective. Because obviously, as I've alluded to, and even as Jordan alluded to when he was on here last week, that, you know, these characters are very strong, and they complement each other. But in order for us to understand that complement, we need to see them individually. So I think that that's what you're getting now. And it totally makes sense, too, that, you know, again, TNG in the sixth and especially the seventh season, it was very strong. You know, that show was, like you said, it had found its place, it found its voice a long time ago, really, and was really, you know, hitting its stride as it was, you know, working its way through its final season. So, yeah, you're getting a lot of peak performances from all those actors. They know their character, they know everything, so they're really into it. Then to go from that to characters who are very new and are still, and actors who are still trying to feel this out, what works and what doesn't, I can definitely see why that would cause a little bit of disconnect. But I think that, especially once you truly finish Next Gen and move more fully into Deep Space Nine and seasons 2 and 3 and so forth, I think you'll see what I see about the show,
right?
And enjoy it even more.
Well, what I would say is, I think the thing that really is the difference right now between the two shows is that Picard is the lead of Next Generation. Every other character is still subordinate to him in both in the story itself, because he's the captain, but also Patrick Stewart. Patrick Stewart is the head of the cast. And so while it is true that that Sisko is the commander of the station, and therefore he is kind of the head of our group, he doesn't get the same lead as Picard does so far. He's not the one. Again, I think I've said it multiple times now. I've been waiting for Sisko to really kind of step up as the lead character, the lead, just to lead the stories, and kind of like Picard does. And so far, that really hasn't happened yet. And I feel like because Sisko is shown to be such a fascinating and great character in that pilot episode, I really want more of him. I feel like he definitely could, as we saw in that pilot episode, he stood up to Picard. He could stand up to Picard. He could be an equal to Picard. And right now, I'm just waiting for the show to really say, yeah, 100%. He's there. Right now, we're just dealing with some issues on the station. This episode is about, we have a prisoner who's escaped, basically. We need to figure out what to do. Sisko is just one of many characters having to deal with that problem. Not that he's bad at his job. He is definitely still the commander of the station. But he even says it, you know, we're guests on the station in this episode. So you feel like he still has yet to take command, even within the story on a certain level. Not that, I mean, he is in charge. Again, don't get me wrong. My point, again, is that this is not Deep Space Nine, Federation, Space Station, Deep Space Nine, headed up by Commander Sisko, or Captain Sisko, as he eventually becomes. He is, I'm just waiting for him to really lead and take charge, and everyone else form around him. And go from there.
So we're definitely going to come back to that, because you said a couple things that, we have to talk about now. But this also gives us a great chance to go ahead and do our recap of the episode. So I'll do a quick rundown this time, because you've been hogging it lately. So in this episode, again, The Passenger, we find ourselves with Kira and Bashir on their way back. In a runabout when they receive a distress call. They answer the distress call, find a ship with its life support failing, there was a fire, and there were 3 passengers on the ship. The pilot is dead, the female officer that we find on the ship is passed out, and there's someone else locked in a secure room, which they force open, and they remove both the female officer and that passenger from the ship. Unfortunately, the other passenger, the male, he dies, and we find out that the the female officer, she's actually the security officer, whose name is Kajada. And she has been hunting the other man that died for 20 years. He is this uber bad mad scientist, basically, named Rayo Vantica.
Right.
I love that name. I don't know why, but I do. And he is, again, he has done everything he can to extend his life, often at the cost of other people. And this is why she was after him. She finds out that they're on Deep Space Nine, which is apparently where Vantica was trying to get to all along, because it turns out that
right.
Deep Space Nine is about to receive a massive shipment of an element known as Deridium. And Deridium
yep.
is something that the Kobliad race, which is what Vantica is, which is what Kajada is, they need to survive. Apparently something has happened to them on their planet. They no longer have this resource anymore, not in an infinite supply, and so their people are dying. And of course, Vantica being a right. terrible individual, he is getting ready to hijack the shipment, hoard it all for himself, and extend his life. And so now they think he's dead, but then all of a sudden things start happening around the station. The computer memory gets wiped, Quark is attacked. Just a couple little things here and there that make them realize that someone is still carrying out Vantica's plan. And as much as Kajada is insisting right. that Vantica is alive, there is just no evidence that he is alive. Dax and
his body is literally yes. in the morgue.
In
sitting
fact,
there, they
yeah.
get confirmation that his DNA is the same. That is the dead body of
every
Rao
way
Vantica.
That they could possibly verify that this is Vantica and that he is dead, they do it. He's dead. Even Kajada even stabs him, like in like one of the opener scenes, she stabs the body, which kind of freaked me out.
I love how Bashir is totally like, you don't just stab
right,
like, a body. He like looks at her funny
right.
but doesn't yeah, but he can't stand up and actually like
right.
say, don't do that. He just like flinches and like looks at her.
So
funny. Keep going.
So
keep going.
She is insisting that he is still alive. Everybody else is like, nah, it's not possible. But then, Dax, being Dax and the wonderful science officer that she is, she finds a disc which has a map of the humanoid brain on it, and this leads her and Bashir into the realization that Vantica could still be alive. He could have transferred his, I think they called it his memory engrams or something like that, to another...
Basically his
right.
wave patterns, his brain
so,
wave
so basically
patterns.
So basically, it's a way for him to transfer his brain to another person and kind of like hijack their brain temporarily and take himself along until he can either find another body or something like that to take over and essentially live again.
Right.
So now there is this, there's enough reasonable doubt cast that Vantica is dead that they are now beginning the hunt to look for him. They, we see Odo and the new security guard from Starfleet, Commander Primin, I believe Lieutenant Primin is his name. He,
mm-hmm.
These two are butting
yep.
heads because Primin is from Starfleet. Odo is obviously not. And Odo is just, he's very much a, either I'm in command of security or I'm not. Either I'm not doing it at all. And so this is that little kind of
right.
B-plot, what's going on between Odo and the struggle for, you know, I guess security supremacy here. They end up working together.
Right.
They figure out that Vantica is trying to hijack a ship. Eventually a ship is hijacked. It almost gets away. And that's when it's revealed that Vantica is alive all the time and that the person that he's been inhabiting is none other than Dr. Bashir, who gives...
Dun, dun, dun.
A amazingly weird performance as a sociopath, in my opinion.
We'll get there.
I think everybody does on this one. When it's revealed that it's Bashir, we're all just like supposed to be shocked. He's strange. He's just. We'll get to that. Ultimately, they figure out a way to use, I think it's the tractor beam, to send some kind of energy pulse, which temporarily
yep.
disrupts Vantica's control over the doctor and allows Bashir's
right.
personality to resurface so that he can shut down the ship and they can bring him home and they can download the rest of Vantica into this little petri dish looking thing, which Kajada, finally relieved to have the true Vantica trapped inside this little dish, she shoots it with the phaser and disintegrates it. And
Oh, I love it. She says to Sisko, she says, "Am I to understand that you have transferred custody of Vantika to me?" He says, "Yes," and she immediately pulls out her phaser and blasts the petri dish
That's
and
it.
Wipes her
That's
hand
the
of
end.
Him. Yep.
And everybody's just kind of standing there looking
I
at her
to
like,
say,
"What?"
Oh yeah,
oh,
we have
gonna,
to discuss if we think
oh, yeah,
that's
we're,
murder
we're gonna
or not.
Get there. We're gonna get there. So yes, that is the episode in a nutshell. I'm sure we missed a couple of things.
Right.
I'm sure we're gonna talk about some things that were not mentioned in the summary. If you know, if that bothers you, you can always go and watch the episode. And as I say always, no spoilers, because the episode's like 30 years old. So if you haven't watched it already, like, what are you doing? Go watch it. We'll be here for you. You can pause
right.
this right now and go watch the episode and come back, and I guarantee you, if you haven't seen it, you'll have a greater appreciation for us. So go watch it and then come back.
Right.
So,
yeah.
That summation being done, of course, I like to ask, what'd you like about this episode?
So one thing I always love to do with any sort of film or TV show is, as the show or film goes along, I like to guess what's going to happen. There's the old saying that, you know, if there's a gun on the mantelpiece in Act 1, it has to go off by the end of Act 3. So if you see it, something being set up, you have to know that there's a payoff somewhere along the line. So if you've seen enough storytelling done, you can sometimes see what's going to come before it happens. And so for me, I kind of I was expecting that our Lieutenant Primin was going to be the new host of Vantika in this episode, because I figured, okay, we have two new actors really for this episode, because the Vantika character dies on the ship when the fire
yeah.
was on it, when they moved the body off. And so I figured, okay, we have other than him, we have this new woman, Kajada, who is the security prisoner guard. And so I figured, like, the episode's like, oh, she must be the one who's been infected by him. And wouldn't that be a terrible fate? She's been, you know, tracking him down for 20 years. Wouldn't it be a terrible fate if she was the one who was ultimately, you know, her brain was overcome and compromised by the personality of the prisoner she'd been fighting and
yeah.
chasing for so long. But I was like, no, if there's a red herring, what's this new guy, this new Lieutenant Primin? I don't recognize him. It'll be perfect. I mean, the whole time I figured he had something to do with either being in league with Vantika, and then, oh, maybe he's the one who's actually going to be Vantika. But then, as soon as they say, oh no, he passed his personality along in a small little device in his fingernail as he was dying. So like 60 seconds before Bashir is revealed to be the villain, I was like, ah, it's Bashir. He was the one who was with them when he died, because he was being Dr. Bashir. And because when he goes to the ship at the beginning of the episode and he finds Kajada dying on the floor, he revives her and then sees that there's a prisoner in that blocked off area. And she tells him, no, don't open it. There's a prisoner in there. If you go in there, he's the one who started the fire. He planned this whole thing. You'll be playing right into his hands. And Bashir, being the good doctor,
the dumb
but also
doctor.
The stubborn-headed fool that he is, yeah, he's the one who goes in there and tries to save him, and ultimately ends up becoming the pawn of his ward, if you will. And so I found that to be kind of a fun little twist.
Yeah.
They got me. They gave me the red herring I needed to think I had figured it out, and then turned it on me. And yeah, man, Dr. Bashir as Vantika at the end was something else. But if we want to wait to talk about that, we
just... I just want to say real quick, like, you've pointed out something yet again that I have noticed throughout my, obviously, many, many times of watching all Trek. And it's the one of those things that sticks with me and is a pet peeve of Trek. And it's that they do such a great job of establishing characters as being brilliant, right? And that they're just again, they're brilliant and they're great at their jobs, but you can always tell when the episode is about them, because they always do something incredibly dumb, and it's just like it takes away from that so-called intelligence that they're supposed to have. And so this episode is a classic example, because the episode opens with Bashir talking about his brilliance. And Kira is ready to just lay into him. Like, she starts off by giving him the compliment.
Oh, I forgot about that.
And he's
that.
Just, you know, you saved that woman. Yeah. I was impressed. And he was like, as well you should be. And then he gives this grand speech about how he just has this remarkable gift to see a problem and he can overcome all these things. And it was yes. so horribly smug.
Oh, it
yes,
was a monologue.
It was teeth yeah. grating.
It yes, was like a villain monologue.
It was awful.
Yeah.
I mean, and yeah. kudos to Alexander Siddig because he delivers it so well. He sounds so smarmy
he does.
And self-satisfying when he says it. It's just like, man, like yeah. I struggled for a long time to like Bashir, and this is why. This is exactly why you gave such a great performance.
Right.
But, again, to immediately follow that with, they beam onto the ship. Yes, it's an emergency. I understand you need to react quickly. But the lady that you just revived is telling you over and over again, don't do it. And he's just like, right. nah, I'm not going to listen to you at all. I'm going in. She's like, don't right. open the door. Don't go in there. He's a murderer. He's a criminal. She's saying all the things. And he's just like, no, no, no. Don't worry. It's fine. I'm just going to open the door. I'm just going to go in there. I'm just going to touch him.
Yeah.
I'm just going to lean down over him. I'm like... my God. And again, this is something that happens in yeah. all of the Treks. Like, there is not a single one that gets away
right.
with it. I mean, I was watching Star Trek Voyager not so long ago, and there's one with the... And you're not going to know any of these names, but I'm going to tell the story anyway because it's real quick. But B'Elanna Torres is the engineer. They're in sick bay. There's this alien creature that's laying on the bio bed in there, and everybody else is like behind this platform, right? And they're talking. And what does B'Elanna do? She walks in front of the platform and puts herself square between like everyone who could help her and hostile alien laying on the bed. And what happens? Alien jumps off the bed and attacks her. And I'm just like, well, of course. Like, why did you walk all the way over there? And that's the thing too. Like, she had started way behind everyone else and then intentionally moved around. And I was like, well, I mean, we already know what's going to happen here. And sure enough, Kirk from, the original series, famous for doing it. Always going somewhere or looking at something or being somewhere he's just not supposed to be so something could hit him or attack him or whatever. And I'm just like, why? Why?
Right.
It's like, come on. So, yeah, that's like, I wish that, you know, don't sell me so hard on these people being top professional, brilliance, A-game, whatever people, and then they do something incredibly stupid like move directly into the path of danger. Like, I refuse to believe anybody that's as intelligent as they say they are would do something so stupid as to put themselves directly in the middle of the danger.
Right. Yeah, as you say that, I think about it, and you're right. You know, anytime an episode's going to focus on a character, and I'm, again, thinking about primarily about Next Generation at the moment, yeah, there's definitely a moment where you focus on that character doing something, and they make some decision that you're like, that was kind of dumb. And, like, that's why the episode happens. Like, their personality trait that caused them to make that mistake causes the plot of the story on some level, and so that's why we got to address this issue, is because that character, who is supposed to be so smart, supposed to be on top of things, was not. They dropped the ball, and now it's their turn to have to deal with the consequences, and we have an episode to work with. So, but yeah, you're totally right. I forgot about that monologue. It is so fantastic in that just self, it's just dripping with self-importance. And it's one of those moments where you have to love how the characters are written, because it's, again, you gotta love to hate them. I find it funny, Perry, you fall for the trap. The writers tell you this character is not likable, this character is self-important, and you go, damn, he is.
I think that's true. Like, I definitely fall for it every time. It's like, I almost look for every time the character that I can love to hate. You know, it's like, I need that so that it's,
because
every other character looks great by comparison, you know? And it's like, and I have to admit, like, even in this scene with Kira telling him, you know, she was giving him the accolades, you know, which is feeding his ego. But then in that last moment where it looked like, I mean, she had clearly reached the end and was getting ready to really kind of ride into him, I have to admit, like, she and got then, bumped up a couple of points because I was so glad. I was like, man, because if I had been in that situation, I'd have done the same thing. And I'm glad that, like, she did it. She just was right there. And I almost wish that we had got to see that continuation, because I feel like Kira could have lit him up, like, just destroy his soul a little bit, bring him down back to human levels. You know, but sorely needing.
Well, what's funny about this episode is, nothing in this episode told him differently, though. He didn't, you know, there's nothing about this episode that's going to make him double think himself next time. This was a one-off. So he's going to, he didn't change. He's still himself by the end, even if he did have a second personality riding along. And again, the passenger being a reference in this episode, both to the fact that there was a prisoner on board the ship, and then he was then Vantika was also a passenger, quote unquote, in Bashir's brain for a time. So
so of course in this episode we also got to see a little bit more of my favorite duo, which is Sisko and Odo. I have loved the pairing of these two for a while. Like their professional demeanors, the way they work with each other, I appreciate it so much. Like, you know, when they're
right,
when they come to the scene where Odo is trying to figure out who's in charge. Is it him? Is it Primin? You know, and he goes into Sisko's office that first time, and Sisko is just like, you know, I already told Primin that he's got to work with you, you know, that you got to have to figure this out. And, you know, he's also telling him, you know, when it comes to matters like this, you're in charge. And, you know, it's that immediate backing that Sisko gives Odo, which... It's weird, and I don't know if you'll agree with me on this, but I feel like the only time we ever really see Odo become even remotely vulnerable is when there's a challenge to his job, to his profession. Because obviously he identifies personally with that job and that sense of justice that it brings. Right. So anytime anything comes up that calls it into question, that's the only time we really see him try to he wavers a bit. And so I love the fact that he goes immediately to Sisko, who instantly backs him up and, like, reaffirms, and it's like, you need to, you know, you're in control. You're in command here. Go for it.
Yeah, Sisko has a great line. He says, you know, Odo's upset, and he's like, I quit. You know, if there's any challenge to my authority, I'm not going to play games. I quit. You know, here's my resignation. And Sisko looks at him and says, I like you, Odo. With you, there's no question about where you stand. You are what you see is what you get, basically. And it's kind of like a backhanded compliment, sort of. Like it's almost like he's saying, "I don't like you, but I'm gonna say it in a way like I do." But you get that he actually means it. It's just one of those moments where, like, these two characters, they might not sit down and enjoy like a cup of tea together, but when it comes to work, they're gonna get things done. And that's what Odo wants. Yeah, for some reason, Odo really holds to this position really important, really, really deeply. You know, I guess I can ask you, maybe we'll find out more, but are we going to learn more about why Odo, like, why he's there on the station, why he is the constable? And in fact, on that point, he says, Sisko says, I call you constable as a term of endearment, and Odo kind of rebuffs him on that. He's like, I don't want your terms of endearment. I want to know where I stand.
And if you notice, Sisko, he actually says... It's a term of affection, and I call you that because I noticed that Kira called you that. And so that's where you got it from. And so that's where it all started. Kira started it, and everybody else just kind of went with it. And he only ever seems to get mad when other people call him. But it's like, he only gets mad about it when, like, again, there's been a challenge to his authority. Like, as long as everything is good and it's clear that he's in control, he does not care. But it's only when someone is, like, making jokes or whatever, then he kind of fires back. I am not the constable. I am the chief of security. You know, like, that's his thing. So, Kira started that. But as it do we find out why he's on the station? No, they don't really say, like, anything specific as to why he came to the station. We're kind of just left with it almost seems like he was always there. Like, we know at some point he was on Bajor, and that was when he was, you know, I guess his formative years. But then at some point he leaves, and he ends up on the station. We don't know if he ever traveled anywhere else and then just came back to the station or what. But at some point he was on Bajor, then he leaves Bajor, he goes to the station, and he's been there on the station ever since. Do we find out why he is the way that he is, like why he's so attached to justice, to order, and so forth? Yes. That is something that we do find out, and I don't know if it's interesting, sad, heartbreaking, whatever, when you find out, because it's just... So when we get there, we'll talk about that. We'll just have to remember that we mentioned this in episode 8, because it's a while before we get there. Okay. But yeah, I just like the way that the two of these individuals operate with each other. You know, like, Sisko is very clear with him. Odo is very clear with Sisko. And, you know, Sisko even tells him, you know, like, yeah, you're in control, you're in command with security, but you can't expect Starfleet to not put somebody here to safeguard their own interests. So he's just like, you know, you're going to have to expect that. And you're going to have to figure out a way to make this work, because we're not going anywhere. Right. And we're not just going to leave you to just do whatever. So, and Odo seems to accept that. So, again, he can accept certain things which limit him in some ways, but as long as ultimately he's the one that's in command, that's where, you know, he's the most comfortable. So, and he does a great job, so I would never take it away from him.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, because Lieutenant Primman definitely does question Odo and say things like, "Hey, why are you talking about this shipment of Deridium that's coming in? It's a sensitive shipment. No one should be talking about it. We shouldn't be advertising it." And Odo's like, "Everyone knows that it's coming. I'm telling Quark that I know that he knows that I know that he knows." That whole back and forth of Odo and Quark is just part of how they work together. And, you know, Odo's right. Quark has been contacted by Vantika, it turns out, to help him plan the theft of this shipment. So Odo was right. Well, you could argue that Odo is just playing the game and maybe there's a better way to do it, but Primman comes in thinking these are things that should be done. Turns out Odo knows what he's doing. But also, you know, Primman actually does prove himself in this episode. He steps out from under Odo's directions and says, you know, I figured that if Vantika did hacked into the computers this way, he'll have hacked into it doing a similar process in a, you know, a different area. And so he's the one who actually kind of saves the day, actually, by allowing the team to stop the ship that Bashir, as Vantika, is on with the tractor beam. They're able to still engage it. So Primman actually saves the day. And actually, it's kind of too bad. I mean, I assume Primman doesn't show up again. You know, it would be kind of interesting to see how Odo and Primman work together. You know, the idea that... Well, I mean, let me put it this way. On the Next Generation, because we're on a starship, there is a chain of command, and therefore there are episodes that deal with the chain of command. And so far, we haven't really established a whole lot what the chain of command is yet on Deep Space Nine. We do in this episode a little bit, but there's no true secondary to Sisko. I mean, we can assume, or at least I'm assuming, it's kind of Kira in a sense. Kira's kind of the second in command, but it's not a clear, like, you're my, well, you know, Picard always calls Riker number one.
Yes, I see what you're saying there. I mean, you're right. Like, I have to admit, like, at first in watching it, I too was a little confused on that, because it was just like, yeah, they never really come out and say it, at least not until later, you know, that she, you know, that, that Kira is the first officer. But, I mean, in other ways, though, like once they say it and then you go back and look, it kind of becomes obvious that she was the first officer. You know, like, they just never really say it, and so I can definitely see that. But yeah, she.
Well, my point is that we definitely have Odo as the head of security, which is like a Worf position, using the Next Generation as an example. But again, it's not like a clear delineation. They're not all wearing
the same uniforms and same, you know,
exactly
the pips,
which makes for an interest. Yeah, it makes for an interesting, you know, question all the characters always have to be asking each other is, where does authority lie and how do we integrate our authority into one cohesive unit?
Which is, again, our highlight of early 90s multiculturalism. Cultures trying to figure out different ways to live and work together and, you know, just trying to figure that out and seeing if it could work at all. You know, Deep Space Nine highlights that very well with the simple fact that, you know, coming from Next Generation, we were, like you just said, we were used to a very clear cut, this is Starfleet, Picard's at the top, we know the chain of command, their uniforms all signify different areas that they work, but we all know, you know, who's in charge, right? And then all of a sudden you go to Deep Space Nine and you're seeing similar colors here and there, but then you've got to throw in the Bajoran militia and the provincial government and the Vedic assembly from, you know, the religious order, and who's doing what and who can do what, and we see basically more a greater influence of what I would call planet-based politics and control over spacefaring politics and control. You know, so we're so used to seeing this unified crew dealing with Romulans and Klingons and so forth, and they present a unified front to that. Suddenly, we're now seeing... Right. We still see some of that, but now they have to take into consideration, okay, well... we know where the Federation stands in regards to the Klingons and the Romulans and whomever, but Bajor is not a part of the Federation. Not yet. They have their own policy. They have their own laws and rules that govern not only their planet, but their space, their solar system. So we have to figure out a way to fold that in there. So what does the Bajoran provincial government say about Romulan ships coming through their space? It could be completely different.
Right.
You know? So, so yeah, there's a lot of that we see in Deep Space Nine, which certainly adds a level of complexity to the show. That as the show goes on and it deepens, I think that it makes the show seem more realistic. Because again, we have to do that all the time. We have to deal with different cultures, and you know, we go into different areas, and like our government, our military goes over into different countries, and you know, we may have our own way of doing things here, but that doesn't necessarily mean we can do that exact same thing over there. And you know, and that's why we have, you know, embassies and stuff like that have certain rights or whatever, but still they're in another country. They're still going to have to observe certain rules and regulations, and trying to figure that stuff out is something that, you know, I guess like the average person wouldn't really have to deal with. And this was all really, really prevalent in the early 90s. We were seeing that a lot with, you know, what was going on in like Bosnia and Kosovo and stuff like that in the early 90s, and coming, and a lot of those refugees coming here and establishing communities here in the United States, you know, and them having that sharp learning curve of going from their country to here and trying to figure out the laws and everything else. So, yeah, once again, Deep Space Nine is very much reflective of the time in which it was aired.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so we kind of went roundabout on that one. All to come back to Bashir as Vantika. Finally going to talk about Bashir as Vantika. So, obviously, Vantika is all about doing anything he can to survive. And as Kajada alluded to earlier, he had done a lot of things to survive. He had conducted experiments on other prisoners to extend his life. He had, you know, stolen certain other types of medical longevity research to extend his life. And now this is his newest thing, body hopping. All right. And so now this extreme desire to live has now basically infected our doctor, and we get to see the doctor in all of his glory. So what do you think of Dr. Bashir as Rayo Vantika?
Well, again, I was able to predict like 60 seconds before the reveal happened that it was Bashir that had been transformed,
inhabited,
overcome, possessed by is the best word, by Vantika. And so when he shows up and it's him, I wasn't quite surprised by that at that point. But Alexander Siddig plays Bashir well in that haughty, I know what I'm doing kind of way. But I don't think I want to see him as a villain again. It was hard for him to pull it off. He looked more silly as this villainous character than he did more believable. He changes his voice to kind of talk more slowly, as if he's having to articulate his words. I'd say one thing. So in college, I took some acting classes for fun. I had friends in the acting department, participated in some plays just for fun. And if there's one thing I learned about acting, it's that you have to commit to the part. So I do not begrudge
Alexander Siddig
playing this villainous part, because he definitely made a choice and went with it, and that's what you learn to do. You have to find a way to commit to a choice and run with it. And so for that point, he does fine. He makes a choice, but again, he feels the character of Bashir better. And if he was a villain again, I'd have to say, okay, let's put you back as Bashir. You're great as this guy who's friendly but also obnoxious and flirtatious but also not good at being flirtatious. He just doesn't come off as a villain. So I was watching and I was just chuckling. It was a little funny performance, especially because we never saw Vantika the whole episode other than that first scene. So this is Vantika as far as we know. This is Vantika.
Villain. Which, if that's truly how he talked, I don't see how anybody ever took this guy seriously, because I would have been like, are you going to like speed it up and get to the point? Because good Lord, you're taking forever. Right. But yes, it is I, Rayo Vantika.
Well,
Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if he was still in his original body, though, I mean, maybe the original body, he had a more physical presence, and so he could give off a physical intimidating presence matching with the voice. But little old Dr. Bashir trying to be intimidating was kind of hilarious. I mean, he does threaten to kill himself and spread the Deridium around the sector and therefore cause, you know, many deaths to the Bajorans themselves. But, he seems willing to follow through on that threat, other than the fact that he seems to be absolutely adverse to dying, whatever the cost. But yeah, it was a funny little, it was a funny performance.
You're right. So, he definitely goes for it. He tries to come off as larger than life, which I guess, I mean, based on what we heard of Bashir early on in the episode, was there really anywhere else for him to go? Like, he certainly couldn't go down. He had to go up. And so the braggadocious nature of Bashir, coupled with the extremely megalomaniacal delusions of Vantika, probably we get this very, very boisterous performance here. To me, it was a moment that definitely takes you out of the immersion of the world, right? Because it was so over the top and also so unexpected that I just got to the point where I was like, I cannot believe this is where we are, you know? So, I think that, again, for an actor, he's basically playing two roles. He's playing Vantika, he's playing Bashir.
Right.
And he's got to do all of that, especially when they, you know, they do the shock treatment, basically, to bring Bashir back. And so he's got to struggle to push the button and the shaky hand and all the rest of it that goes on. You know, I was just like, okay, you know. just do it. Just do it. But, yeah, still one of those things that stands out to me as a could he have dialed that back? Like, he was at a 12. He should have stayed at 10.
Right.
He went to 12. But yeah.
Went to 11.
No, that's why I skipped it all the time. Yeah. He went to 12. He was that over the top. He went to 12.
You know, I will say, I think there's one thing that could have done to kind of redeem that kind of over the top performance. If at some point the line had been like, this body, I don't like this body I've ended up in, that would have been hilarious. Like, all this faux intimidation would have been suddenly kind of undercut and funny, but made it a little more believable that Vantika had to pick the only choice he had when he was dying, and that was Bashir, and Bashir was not the person he would have picked if he had had a choice. Maybe he would have picked Sisko or something, like, I wish I could have found the commander or something. I don't know. You could have said something funny like that. But oh well. That's retroactively trying to change things. So
now, of course, I'd like to do our, you know, deep in the 90s. I don't know what. I should get a name for this segment. Our 90s time.
I'm telling you,
We'll work on it. We've got to get that nailed down. So obviously, this episode features a lot of right to life stuff. You know, we have Vantika, who is doing everything he can to extend his life. You know, we find out about the Kobliad species, their need for this Deridium. There's not enough of it to go around, and this guy who has repeatedly done everything he can to survive, right? And whereas right. in some, you know, some cultures, you know, the right to life is absolute. You know, we see here that basically all the things that Vantika has been doing has been seen as, you know, reprehensible acts, and they're trying to imprison him at the very least.
Right.
So, for the 90s, we kind of had the opposite of that. We had a individual who believed in the right to death, the right to die on your own terms. And that was, of course, Dr. Jack Kevorkian, known also as Dr. Death. Kevorkian was a legitimate doctor who practiced physician-assisted suicide. His major case that brought him to the height of fame was in 1998 when he was arrested, when he tried to commit what was known as voluntary euthanasia of a man who at the time was suffering from ALS. So in that trial, Kevorkian was tried and convicted of second-degree murder. He was sentenced to, I think, 25 years in prison, of which he only served 8 years. But it became this long-standing, debated, controversial topic throughout much of the 90s. You know, do you have a right to die? Do you have a right to take your own life? And then, of course, I guess you have a right to do it with a physician assisting your suicide, right? I mean, like, obviously, if someone decides to commit suicide, you know, there's not really much right. we can do to really stop them. We have hotlines and like that are set up to dissuade people, but, you know, ultimately, if a person decides to take their own life, nothing we can really do about that. But the problem here was that Kevorkian, as a doctor, obviously, he was using his medical knowledge to kill these people. And, yeah, that was the controversy. Should that be allowed or not? So, right. I'm just going to throw it out there. How do you feel about both of these? Right? Do you feel like a right to life is absolute, and do you also feel that a person has a right to die, a right to a doctor helping them end their life on their own terms?
So, on the question of right to life, in the sense of, do you have the right to hurt, damage, or otherwise deprive someone else of their life to extend your own? I mean, I imagine absolutely everyone will agree. Of course not. You couldn't, if you need a blood transfusion, you don't have the right to go kidnap someone and then suck, you know, drain their blood and then infuse it into yourself and then, like some sort of weird vampire, go around and do that to everyone until you just finally die. That's not an acceptable choice. So this character of Vantika, in some ways, it'd be kind of fun to learn more about his history. Like, what did he do? Like, not a fun way, and like, oh, that's cute. But like, if this was an evil character, if we could have gotten more of how he was evil, how Kajida was able to track him down, if we could get more of their personal story, that I think would be interesting. But of course, we don't have time for that. Now, in terms of the right to die, I personally don't believe that you should engage in that sort of thing, if only because it's a slippery slope. If you have the thought in your culture that people can not only kill themselves, but that other people can recommend, like a doctor can recommend that you kill yourself and then assist you in doing so, that's just a slippery slope. That's just at what point do you say, we don't, like, you know, you have some sort of disability, you may not think that you should die. You're willing to live, but I don't think that your, you know, condition, like whatever disease you're living with, is worth living with. It'd be better for you to die, and therefore I make that decision on your behalf. So it's a very slippery slope. I can understand someone saying, I'm in such pain that I wish I was dead. I can totally understand that. I personally have never experienced that type of pain, so on some level, I think that's also the question of, you know, where is the limit of, you know, if someone says, I'm experiencing so much pain, I want to die, I can understand that on a physical level, you're physically experiencing such pain that you feel that you would rather die than continue to experience it. If you're experiencing emotional pain, my answer is, emotional pain can be dealt with through therapy. We can find ways to deal with emotional pain. So no, I would not be for that. And again, if you're in physical pain, and therefore you feel like you should die. All I can say is that there have been people throughout history who have dealt with extreme pain and have either dealt with it or overcome it. As a Christian, I believe that people can be healed from physical pain. I'm not necessarily saying miracles, but I'm saying that we have, in our current age, much more medical understanding of the body, and as we continue to understand more and more, we'll be able to address those issues more and more. And so to say that I am done with living, I'm in so much pain that I'd rather not be living, I think it's just simply a mistake of judgment. Again, I've never experienced so much physical pain that I would, you know, say, oh, I know what it feels like, and I overcame it, and therefore everyone should follow my example. Not saying that at all, but definitely think that if we were to go down Kevorkian's belief that people should be allowed to... I do not understand his philosophy fully enough to... Maybe I'm misquoting him, but if his argument is that people have the right to kill themselves at any time for any reason, and I'm for that, I think that he's just making a mistake on for his own part, you know, to be a part of that. That just seems just kind of dirty. Like, you know, if you're a doctor, there's always that statement of, you know, do no harm. This is like the exact opposite of that. It feels like, you know, you're actually physically helping in death, and that just feels wrong. And then again, to any person who's feeling like they would rather die than go forward with life on whatever, for whatever reason, emotional, physical, whatever, I always feel like I'm sure that we can help you find a way to deal with that pain. I myself am not a doctor, so I can't personally express a knowledge of what that would be, but that's what we should be striving for. So that would be my opinion on the subject.
Well... So before I give my own, I'm just going to clarify a little bit there with Kevorkian, you know. So he basically, his main statement was always that dying was not a crime, okay? And he only really, I guess we want to say, tackled cases where a patient was definitely in, you know, a considerable amount of pain.
Right.
So, with that being said, you know, he assisted in a great deal of assisted suicides, even developing a machine to do so. From the again, it was like the early 90s. Like I think his first case was in 89. Yes, I'm reading it now. His first case was in 89 with a woman who had Alzheimer's. And then between 90 and 98, he assisted in over 130 suicides. So, right. And again, the machine that he developed, it was called the Thanatron, which, I mean, say nothing of names, but good Lord. Basically, all it did was, you know, it would hook the person up so that intravenously they could ultimately push the button to administer the drugs that would end their life. He did not actually like do the full thing of sticking the needle in and then plunging it down and then the person would die. He had them hooked up on various machines, and when they ultimately decided that the pain was too great and things were too much, that they could do it themselves. So for me, I feel like as much as you have a right to life, you have a right to your own death. Like you said, I don't agree that you have the right to extend your life at the cost of another person. So yeah, you know, like right. If you need a kidney, you can't kidnap somebody and take their kidney. Like, no. You know, right. But obviously we have organ transplants, organ donation, things like that, which, you know, are perfectly legal and they're regulated, and you should definitely right. use those if you need to use those. You know, but 100%. Yeah, doing anything else that would cause another person intentional pain or injury just so that you can live a little bit longer is unacceptable. However, beyond that, doing everything else you can to live a full life, absolutely. I feel like you have a right to that. And anything that stands right. in the way of that, you should challenge. And then also, I guess the same goes for right to death for me. I mean, if you are if you've reached a point where something is preventing you from living a full life, I think that you have a right to, you know, at least evaluate what going on, trying to continue, would be for you. But that, again, I put the caveat on there. That's only in extreme cases. Like, if you know, for example, that you are terminally ill with cancer and that eventually this cancer is going to kill you. They've told you, there have been multiple tests, and they're just like, I mean, all we can do right now is do chemo over and over and over again, but unfortunately, all it's going to do is just, it just buys you time. It's costly, and it's buying you time. That's it. You're still going to die in 8 months, 10 months, whatever. If that person decides, I don't want to go through the pain and the nastiness of chemo and how it weakens my body and destroys me over and over again just for 8 more months, and instead they're like, while I still feel fit and feel healthy and feel fine, I want to go out and, you know, on my own terms, on my own strength, I'm totally for that. Now, I know there are some people who would disagree because they're like, oh, you don't know, medical science could change and they may suddenly go into remission. And it's like, okay, yes, those things have happened. But if we look at the grand scheme of all of that, those things don't happen nearly as often as people think they do. And rather than making a person, rather than making a person suffer with something so debilitating, if they choose to go out having fun and doing the thing, I'm for that. You know, let that be there. Well, you know, who knows? Like, I'm saying, like, while they, like, they've been diagnosed, right? They know it's terminal. Right. The doctor's like, all chemo's going to do is wear you out until you finally die in 8 months. But if you don't do the chemo, you're going to die in 2 months. So they're like, okay, so chemo's only going to give me 6 more months, and I'm going to feel awful the whole time. Well, screw that. I'm going to save my money, and I'm going to use my money to go places I've never been before and have elaborate parties with friends and family before I go, and, you know, make sure my loved ones are taken care of, and then die. And I would like that death to be as pain-free as possible. And there's a doctor who's willing to make sure that on that day that they chose, that it is as pain-free as possible.
Right.
I'm for that. I'm that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't agree that just because, like, no, we're going to make you linger for another six months and you're bedridden and you're in pain and you're injected with chemicals and you can barely focus, you know, you're not you're barely conscious, like, all that. No
I guess I would say two things to that. I would say, first off, that who determines, well, let me put it this way, we're all going to die eventually, so if we take that argument too far to the extreme, we could all argue that we should just off ourselves right here and now to offset any pain we'll experience. So that's the extreme end of that argument. That's just one small point. But the second point I would say is this, and I think this is actually kind of ties in closer to what my point would be. It has been shown, and I can't point to a study, so forgive me, but it's been shown, but to my understanding, that people who have a drive to live recover from certain diseases. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, if you have terminal cancer, you have stage 4 cancer, you know, oh, you're going to will yourself to live. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that people who give up and say, oh, I'm never going to recover, they have a higher death expectancy. There's actually something to say about your willingness to kind of fight it. And again, I don't have any study right in front of me that I could point to. We're just talking about it. But if that is true, then for me, it's like, I personally would say, like, whatever happens to me, I'm going to, the living means something. And even if that means suffering for 6 months in cancer treatment, that would suck. But death is not something that we should want to bring on any sooner than it could. Therefore, I'm going to fight for as long as I can. And if I can actually fight and that helps my body, like, somehow get the energy to, like somehow my emotional health and my physical health are actually a little more connected than we might expect, then, man, I'm gonna go for it. That's like, as a follow-up to my point.
Well, and I mean, and you make a good point. I'm not going to deny that at all. I'm just saying that, you know, like you were saying, you know, almost, well, I mean, since we all know we're going to die, then yeah, we could, but we could just, you know, off ourselves. But I'm just saying, like, that to me is such an extreme that I don't feel like that's realistic,
right?
Because it's like,
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I totally understand. Yeah. I'm saying it's the
examples that I – the example I gave and then examples I would continue to give only really revolve around people who we know for sure that whatever affliction they have, there is no recovery. Okay? This is not a, oh, well, you know, we've got reports where, you know, 40% of people could eventually live. You may or may not be in that 40%. Like, no. I'm not saying that. This is for those cases where we know there is no recovery. There is no coming back from this. All that current medical science can do is just extend that time. Right. You're still going to die. It's just going to extend that time. Right. Those are the cases where I feel like those people have absolutely a right to choose whether or not they want to stick around until the very end, you know, what that time is, or if they decide, no, I want to do this other thing and then go out in a different way. You know, I know that you were saying, you know, like some people who, you know, they have other afflictions which are not life-threatening, but because they argue in their head that, you know, it's a debilitating life issue, like, you know, I could see that argument being made for people who are amputees of some kind, you know, like they've lost a leg and they feel like their quality of life is so diminished that there's just no point in carrying on. I would advocate for those people that they're not candidates for termination, you know. I mean, because we have plenty, because in those cases, obviously, we have plenty of studies, overwhelming studies, and just people who live full lives as amputees, you know.
Right.
So those people would not qualify, because I'm just like, okay, well, like, we have, like, you can just throw a dart at a board, and we're going to hit somewhere where there's somebody who is an amputee that lives there, and they have a great life. So, no, we're not going to end your life because right now you feel a little sad that you lost your leg, your foot, your arm, whatever it is. No.
Right. I have to quickly mention that there was an episode on Next Generation, it's called Half a Life, where Luxwana Troi falls in love with
elderly man who was 60 and was going to die, because that was the society.
That's right. Well, it's his society has a cultural agreement that everyone at the age of 60 will engage in a ritual where they will engage in ritual suicide. And he decides briefly while with Luxwana to not do so because she convinces him not to do that. She thinks it's terrible and horrible, and he briefly agrees with her. But then his daughter shows up on the ship and says, look, this is part of our culture. You've taught me that this is a good thing. You're betraying everything you say you believe in. Don't change your mind. You know, engage in this. And he does. At the end of the episode, we don't see it, but he decides to go back to his people and let them. And he engages in the ritual suicide, we assume. And part of what the argument that he makes is that, look, I failed in this experiment I was trying to do on the Enterprise. So part of what this ritual is to give a chance for new people to come along and follow up on my work and continue where I left off. It's a strange argument. Again, I don't agree with it, as we've just discussed, basically. But, yeah, this is not the first time that – well – we're bringing up this whole right to death argument in relation to this episode from Deep Space Nine, but the Next Generation actually addressed this.
Well, they actually do it a couple times, because they did it there, and they did it when Worf was injured with his spinal injury and left him paralyzed.
That's
and
right.
And he legit tried to commit suicide. He was going to have Riker bring him the knife to kill himself, and Riker refused, and that was a fantastic episode. And Picard and Beverly are, you know, Beverly is trying to make him see that he can live a full life even as a paraplegic.
Yes.
And she even goes to Picard, and Picard's like, in his society and in Klingon culture, this is how they handle it. And you're asking him to do something that generations of his people have handled in this particular way. You're asking him to make a leap that he can't make, and that's a favorite scene of mine, because he's like, it's too far. You're asking him to do something that he can't do, you know. And rather than see that, you're trying to force this issue. And I mean, I think on all levels they handled that one beautifully, from Picard and
even all that was fantastic. But the best part of that episode was that Dr. Crusher has a guest doctor, I don't remember her name, but she has a guest on her ship who's also a doctor who engages in experimental
techniques to extend a person's life.
And who, Well, yeah, but she what she does is actually she kills people.
Yeah, she's
on,
that's
like,
right.
They
she's experimenting
help.
With various drugs. Like, right. She's like, well, the potential of the drug to save people later on is worth killing someone now. And so
Yes. So she is right there in the grayest of grays, and Dr. Crusher is like, hell no, you don't come on my ship and just play around with life. But ends up in the end helping her do the spine replacement surgery for Worf.
Great,
that was a great episode.
When Worf died, I have to admit, like, that was one of those that I was like, I'm gonna have to walk away for a minute. Y'all just killed my favorite character. Right. Like, you don't know what that does. Yeah. TNG does a great job on both counts on handling that.
And
maybe one day we'll get into doing a comparison. But we unfortunately don't have the time to do that tonight. We're over. A little bit over, but that's okay. We can make this work. So we'll round it out real quick. What did you think of this episode overall? The Passenger, by the way. We're back to talking about Deep Space Nine. What did you think of this episode?
The Passenger. I thought it was fine. Perfectly fine episode. Don't have any real complaints about it. But while we were researching the episode, I found that, according to Wikipedia, this episode, according to a 2016 issue, I guess, of Atlantic Classic Comics, this episode is rated dead last of all 173 episodes from Star Trek Deep Space Nine. I don't know how they're getting that ranking, if it's just a personal ranking. But also in 2019, Screen Rant said this is one of the 10 worst episodes from Deep Space Nine. I'm curious if you agree with that, and if that's true, then I guess we have a long way upward to go.
I mean, no, because I don't agree with these things, because as with most things, I feel like you have to appreciate episodes like this with a rewatch or a couple of rewatches. You know, in most of these rankings, it's always somebody who has very little to no experience with Star Trek. They watch the episode one time, and because it didn't do enough pew 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 for them, they just mark it down, and it's terrible. And so I never take any of those things seriously. Like, it's only when, if you want to like really find legit rankings, to me anyway, what I would consider legit rankings, go somewhere where like diehard fans are talking about episodes, and when they tell you an episode is a low point, I'm more inclined to believe that, because they know the show, they've watched it several times, they've watched other shows that are along the same iteration several times, so they know what to look for. And so if they tell me the episode is terrible, then yes, I'd be more inclined to believe them, not these one-off weirdos who they're just writing an article to get their name out there, and what better way.
You hear that, Screen Rant? You're a one-off.
No, I'm just saying, it's just like, it's, you know, Screen Rant, I mean, they've been, that name has been around doing things for a while, but I wouldn't be surprised if they're just turning and burning authors, quote-unquote authors, for these articles, and it's just somebody's writing something just to get their name out there, just to say, hey, I'm published. And what better way to gain, you know, attention than by writing something writing something negative? Everybody loves to read the negative thing, right? You know, so I think that's what this is. It's just an ever-ending cycle of, let's bash something that really that person doesn't really understand. This is the way to get people to at least view what they wrote, you know. The episode, I'm not saying that the episode is like pinnacle Trek. It's like an apex example or anything like that. But it definitely offers a lot. And considering this is also the eighth episode of the first season of this show, and there was a lot going on back then, I feel like they put together something that was overall entertaining, you know. And we get a lot of great other things throughout the episode, like Kira and Bashir's interaction at the beginning of the episode. Great comedic stuff right there. You know, Sisko and Odo and their developing relationship, and we're seeing those strong ties between the two of them come out. Even Quark being Quark when he's crawling around on the floor looking for drop change and things like that. Like, it's minute, but it highlights the character so well that it makes everything that's going to come after it better, because we know that's the kind of person he is. Like, anytime anybody's like, well, I wish Quark was a bit more redeeming, we can always be like, okay, you remember when he was literally crawling on the floor looking for valuables that people drop? Like, the man is without scruples, all right? So, he wasn't trying to find it so that he could return it to the rightful owner. He even says to the guys, leave, I will find it and keep it myself. Like, he's greedy.
Right.
You know, so it's things like that you would not appreciate as just a one-off watch. You wouldn't get it. It wouldn't resonate with you. You have to watch it a couple of times before you really see those things. So yeah, that's why I don't pay attention to stuff like this.
Right.
Well, all right. Final thoughts before we wrap this up.
Oh, I think I've said everything I could say.
Well, all right, guys. Yeah. That's going to be it for us today. We did run a little bit over. We do apologize. But I'm sure you enjoyed it because you got to hear some great opinions on this episode. So, once again, this has been The Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. Please feel free to follow us on Twitter, on Facebook. I don't think we're going to do an Instagram. I don't really want to do an Instagram, but we'll see. I'll have to talk to some other people before we decide that or not. But Facebook and Twitter are up and running, so you can find us there, and you can listen to us anywhere you listen to podcasts. I personally do it on Spotify. So again, that's The Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. Take care of yourselves, and we'll see you next week. Have a good one.
Thanks, guys.